From WUFT-FM, this is Animal Airwaves Live, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill. Today is Friday, October 15th, 2021, and I'm live today with one of my favorite guests from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Jim Wellahan is here, and we're going to be talking about a kind of unusual mortality event affecting gopher tortoises. There's a lot to discuss, and I hope you'll stay tuned to Animal Airwaves Live coming up after this news from NPR. WUFT-FM, welcome to Animal Airwaves Live. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm so happy to welcome back to the program today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Jim Wellahan, one of my favorite guests here on the program, because I always learn a great deal when he's on. And so let me welcome you back to the program, Dr. Wellahan. It's really good to see you. We've spoken in the last year or so, but it's nice to have you here in person.
It's nice to be here. Thank you very much.
We're going to be talking today about the implications of emerging diseases in gopher tortoises and other reptiles. But before we kind of get into that, let's talk a little bit about these reptiles that we have here in Florida that maybe many people listening to this program will never have encountered in person. But they're special animals, gopher tortoises.
Yeah, they're wonderful animals. They actually are keystone species. Their burrows are important habitat for a variety of other species to survive.
They are long-lived animals if they remain healthy. They can have extremely long lives as far as animals go.
Yeah, they should live longer than people do.
Which is wonderful, and that makes this event that's kind of underway and this disease so vexing, because we want these animals to live a long time, and yet something is happening that can really truncate their lives. What's going on?
Well, there's a few things going on, and I, before jumping into that, I think one of the things that is especially challenging about turtles and tortoises is when you kind of look at the ecology of how various animals reproduce. There's kind of a couple of strategies that are taken. Like, you can take the approach that humans and elephants do and have a small number of young and invest a huge amount of energy into parenting and making sure that those young have a really good chance of survival. Or you can kind of take an approach like frogs and mosquitoes, where you just have piles and piles and piles of babies and hopefully some of them will make it. But tortoises do something different than what most other species do. And that a clutch of tortoise eggs isn't very big. You know, a six gopher tortoise eggs is a pretty big clutch for a gopher. And what they do is survive for a long time as adults. and their parental care is pretty much absent. Once the nest is buried, that's it. And the survival rate of nests is not very high. I mean, most of them get dug up by raccoons and various other things. And so their whole strategy is very tied up in having these healthy adults living a long time. And so they can be much more impacted when you lose an adult animal can cause a local extinction, you know. And so it's making them very susceptible to some of the challenges that we're posing now.
So am I correct in my understanding that, you know, a female gopher tortoise will lay a bunch of eggs on the beach somewhere or in the sand somewhere?
Generally not on the beach. That's a sea turtle thing.
Okay, sea turtle thing, yeah. But somewhere in the sand, in the dirt.
Yep.
Okay. And then she's gone.
Then she's gone.
And she's probably never going to see them again.
Babies are on their own. Yeah.
Yeah. And once they emerge, of course, they're quite small and susceptible to predation.
The survival rate for hatchlings is not very high.
Yeah. I mean, because, gosh, any number of animals wants to eat the little ones.
Yeah.
And they probably have to be above a certain size before they're safe from predators.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know about how big they would have to be, but at some point, a hawk's not going to carry you off.
You're never 100% safe. We still have a lot of challenges with dogs taking out a dog. You know, one of the more common things we see in the ward with rehabilitated tortoises is that dog predation, you know, but it has to be a fairly large predator to take out an adult gopher tortoise, and that doesn't happen all that often on the scale of things.
Yeah. And so their long life, does that mean that they can have more offspring? What's their reproductive life like?
They are, tortoises are really, and turtles in general, there's a turtle researcher who followed this group of turtles in Michigan for over 50 years, and they didn't really seem to senesce. The reproductive success of the older females just increased with time. So they basically go until they stop.
which is great because, yeah. I mean, if you were living for 100 years and, you know, let's say 90-something of those years is, like, productive in terms of offspring, even if you're only having a handful at most of eggs at a time, you know, you can be prolific in that way. How many times can they lay eggs in, say, the course of a year?
Generally, you get one clutch a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what I wonder then is about the diversity of these animals. In any given area, would you find a large number of gopher tortoises related to each other?
They are definitely not one of those species that, you know, migrates over the Gulf of Mexico. And, their ability to disperse is lower than a lot of other species is going to be. It's going to depend on the carrying capacity of the habitat as to, you know.
I mean, because it may come to pass then that, you know, some, gopher tortoise lays some eggs and they survive, and then, you know, further down the road, gopher tortoises that are actually related to one another are reproducing together.
Yep.
Does that have any risks in terms of the kind of durability of gopher tortoises to withstand diseases and so forth?
Absolutely. Habitat fragmentation is when we're building roads and things to separate off populations, they're one of the more impacted species by that because their dispersal ability is decreased compared to, you know, birds and faster things.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone who's lived in Florida for any length of time can acknowledge that there is less habitat for wildlife than there formerly was. Yeah. I mean, gosh, just in my lifetime, the population of Florida has something like doubled, right? And so that is has tremendous implications for areas in which gopher tortoises might live, especially when you go to some of these places where it's obvious that new neighborhoods are being built in areas that were, you know, relatively not wild, like in the terms of, you know, what they might have out west, but certainly it's scrubland. It's places where gopher tortoises might have lived.
Yeah.
And so there are a number of pressures that these animals are under.
Yep.
And now you can add to it disease that wasn't formerly something that afflicted them in a substantial way.
Well, I don't know that I can necessarily say that, but all of these various impacts add up together and disease, you know, when you're a species whose reproductive strategy is so tied up in having adults, a disease taking out an adult can have a bigger population effect. And we're seeing, you know, as conditions change too. I mean, they're as a cold-blooded species, you know, they're very dependent on what's the temperature outside for a variety of basic metabolic functions. Their immune system, you know, responds different at different temperatures. So when we start seeing changes in temperatures that they're exposed to, that's going to impact their immune function, and certainly is a concern there. And actually, there are species who, you know, when if you know, we both have kids. Our kids are determined by our chromosomes, you know, and as far as their gender goes or sex goes, tortoises have temperature dependent sex determination, and so when it's warm, you have girls, and that's been a bit of a challenge. But there have been studies looking at sea turtles, especially in Australia, where they have been finding that it's been all girls hatching, and that has, you know, as as things warm up, that can have significant population level impacts too. And all of these things, you know, infectious disease never happens in a vacuum. It's always this factor is impacting a species, and this factor is impacting a species, and this factor is impacting a species, and it's and they come together to cause problems.
Yeah, getting back to the reproduction, if all of them turn out to be girls, I can see how that's a problem.
Yep.
But if you had like four of them girls and one of them boys,
that's less of a problem.
That's less of a problem. I can almost see how that would be fun.
From a population level standpoint, the females are really the valuable ones for reproductive capacity. But it reaches a point where if they can't, reproduce sexually, then that's not so valuable.
No, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, I see what you're saying, that any other kinds of pressures, be it, you know, from habitat loss to climate change and all of this, makes these animals that much more vulnerable to other potentially, mortal kind of events, of which disease certainly qualifies. Are gopher tortoises and other reptiles subject to a good number of diseases? Is that something that is kind of a concern overall in the life of some of these reptiles like gopher tortoises, or do they usually die of some other cause?
It is a concern. The kind of the first one that was really worked up and has been known for, probably close to 30 years now is there's a mycoplasma or mycoplasmoides now that's been renamed. Mycoplasmopsis agassizii is a cause of upper respiratory tract disease in gopher tortoises, but it's one cause. And when we see the group of bacteria that they belong to tend to be fairly slow developing disease, and it causes a significant rhinitis, and there have been experimental infections done that's a problem. But when we look at, what should normally go on in the nose, the whole GI tract of any vertebrate is a complex ecosystem. Most of the cells in you or I or a tortoise are not vertebrate cells. They're bacteria. And there's so much normal diversity there. And it's kind of like, you can think of it like a rainforest. And when things go way out of whack and something takes over and you have a forest fire and things burn down, it doesn't necessarily come back the same way. And how all of these things interact together is important. So if you have Burmese pythons in Burma, that's okay. That's a system that's evolved to have Burmese pythons in it, and they fit well into that ecosystem. If you introduce Burmese pythons into the Everglades, they take out more than 99% of mammals, and that didn't go so well, and it's continuing to not go so well. And so it's really about context and ecology. And we have too often painted infectious disease as a black and white process, and it's a complex ecological process.
Yeah, I think a lot of us can really wrap our heads around the idea of introducing a species that doesn't belong in a particular habitat and the destruction that can cause. In your example of the pythons down in the Everglades is really a good one. I think we can all kind of understand what happens when you've got an animal that isn't supposed to be there and the destruction that it can cause. I like this analogy in terms of, infectious disease and bacteria and so forth, because that's maybe not a way that the public, like myself, have really thought about it before. But you're introducing something in these animals where, it might not have a natural defense for it for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, and so we're just starting to figure out, what is normal and how do we? I hope that 20 years from now, when we're dealing with a patient with microbial related health problems, we're trying to figure out how do I create a healthy ecosystem as much as we're trying to figure out how do I go in and kill stuff. Because the usual answer now is to hit things with broad spectrum antibiotics and hope you take out the thing and hope that what comes back afterwards is good. And, the things that are good at coming back into depopulated systems like that tend to be the most invasive species.
So. Well, I mean, is it Let's just ask this question right off the bat. Is it better that this is bacterial in nature than viral?
I don't know that I could say better or worse. That would be a hard thing to specifically say. We do see viruses in tortoises. We see fungal diseases in tortoises. We see protozoal diseases in tortoises. We see viral bacterial diseases in tortoises. So there's a variety of things, and I think they can, you know, come together to create health, or they can come together to cause problems.
We've got a lot more to talk about here as far as this goes, but just as an outline right now, you're seeing more and more of these gopher tortoises come in with this particular bacterial infection.
So this bacteria, the first case we saw, this was actually in 2012, and it was a gopher tortoise that came into the. We do a lot of wildlife rehabilitation at the vet hospital, and this was a gopher tortoise that just came in and was in reasonable body condition. But it just looked sick and out of it, and it had pretty bad nasal discharge. And we were like, well, you know, we were thinking it was probably mycoplasmopsis, which was kind of the known thing out there. And we did a cytology from the nose, and the bacteria that came back were all these spiral-shaped things, which isn't what mycoplasmopsis looks like. And so we then took some samples from it, and normally in a nose, there should be lots and lots of different bacteria present. And we ran a PCR that should amplify all the different bacteria. And when you do that on a traditional sort of regular Sanger sequencing, and you've amplified a whole bunch of different bacteria, you should get back kind of it looks like all the letters are written on top of each other, and it's just kind of an illegible mess. And we didn't get that. We got pretty legible Helicobacter sequence. So Helicobacter is a genus of bacteria that the best known member of the family is Helicobacter pylori, and that's associated with ulcers in people. It was kind of came out in the 1980s that, oh, you get this bacteria and you get ulcers. And that's a more complicated story than it really is, but that's how the public is generally familiar with, oh, it's the bacteria associated with ulcers.
And so you're seeing, you know, the results of your investigation, and what it shows, and if I have this correct, is less of the diverse array of bacteria that you might normally find in the nose of these of these tortoises, and a lot of this bacteria that you don't expect to
find. A lot of this one bacteria. And there have been a couple of studies where they've done what's called metagenomics, where you just look at the diversity of what's present. With the advent of some of these next-generation sequencers, where I can take, you know, a bunch of nucleic acid from a sample and put it on a thing and get 30 million sequences back in a couple hours, I can look at, you know, diversity of populations present now in ways that we really didn't used to be able to do so well. And there have been a couple of studies that were done on some of the North American tortoise species, including gopher tortoises, and they took a look at what was present in their noses, and Helicobacter was not one of the things that was normally present in a bunch of healthy tortoise noses. And I should add, too, that another thing that they found was that the healthier tortoises that didn't have signs of upper respiratory tract disease had greater bacterial diversity in their nose, and that diversity was significantly associated with health.
All right. So I think that you've set us up really well, Dr. Wellehan, for the rest of our discussion, and there'll be more Animal Airwaves Live coming back right after this. You're listening to WUFT-FM. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Jim Wellehan. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live on WUFT-FM. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine is our friend Dr. Jim Wellehan. And today's topic is the implications of emerging diseases in gopher tortoises and other reptiles. When we left off, Dr. Wellehan, you had just been talking about this bacteria that you found that was discovered when, back, you say, in 2012, right?
The first case we saw was in 2012, and that was just kind of a one-off. When you have, you know, an N of one of cases, it's hard to say much about it. So we just kind of kept that one on the back burner. And then in 2016, we had another case come in, presented pretty much identically, and again, died despite some aggressive supportive care. And so at that point, there was an undergraduate student who had approached me about a few things, Tasha Desiderio. And she's now a vet student. She's wonderful. And so this turned into our honors project, looking at the diversity of this. So we started, after having two cases of this present, we're like, well, let's characterize this a little better. So the first thing we did, you know, the initial gene that we had gotten to characterize it, there's a ribosomal RNA, and it's a very conserved, it actually functions as RNA in your ribosomes. So it's really important for turning the genes that are encoded by other RNAs into proteins. So and because it's functional not as a protein but as an RNA itself, there are bits that are the same between you and I and E. coli. And so you can find some very conserved areas. But it's not so good for really looking at diversity because it's so conserved. So we decided we would go grab a couple other genes and characterize it and see how it was related to some other things. And once we had these other genes, we could also develop some cheaper and quantitative tests that were very specific. So we could look at how much bacteria is present in a given sample, and it would, rather than amplifying all kinds of different bacteria, it would amplify just this Helicobacter. And so that was, so we started, we developed these tests, we validated that they worked, and then we started surveying tortoises that were coming through the ward and were in a rehabilitation setting. And tortoises, you know, some of these were coming straight out of the wild, and some of these were animals who, tortoises do a lot of things really well, but they don't do a lot of things really fast. And so, you know, when we have an injured animal come in, it's often there for months and months and months. And you know, to get some of these, when they've got defects in their shells because they've, you know, had a piece broken off or something like that, they can take quite an extended time to heal up. So we had a reasonable population of animals, and we started surveying them. And then we just started looking what were the clinical correlations between, you know, how do these things do and what's their Helicobacter load. And I have to admit, I was pretty floored when I found out that the strongest correlation between having this Helicobacter load and clinical outcomes was the correlation with death was really strong. These things were dying within a year when they had this in their nose. And so it was a big surprise because the you know, a lot of things you can go through and say, hey, here's a very specific lesion. You know, pathologists are critical for any sort of disease investigation. And it's, you know, and we do see lesions where these things are colonizing their nose, and you can see spiral-shaped bacteria with special stains that are there. But the whole systemic lesions, these animals are dying really quickly. And when you look at them histologically, there's just, if you happen to see the bacteria in the blood, great. But most of the time, you don't have any sort of specific lesion to hang your hat on that says this is what causes it. So that's why it was so surprising to say, hey, wait, this really correlates really strongly with being dead because you don't have a very, what's called a pathognomonic lesion.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a lot here to talk about. So these individuals that died.
Yeah.
And one in 2012, one in 2016.
Yeah.
Were they otherwise? Like, they weren't like 100-year-old gopher tortoises. They were
adults.
They were adults, but they weren't at the end of their lifespan, presumably.
I don't think so, but it's a little hard to, you know, it's a little hard to precisely age a gopher tortoise, honestly.
Sure. Okay. But they might have otherwise been healthy. And you're talking about a correlation, and I noticed that you use the word correlation because you're not able to definitively say that this is what killed them.
Absolutely, yeah. That's completely true. We have not done experimental infections. We actually, one of the challenges is this bacteria doesn't grow very well. We have not yet been able to culture it. So all of our diagnoses have been based off of sequencing genes out of them, rather than growing the bacteria out of it.
Let me ask you this: is there any reason to suspect that, or is there any way to know whether the mere presence of this unusual bacteria is as bad or worse than the absence of some of the other bacteria that you might expect?
Not at this point, no. Yeah.
Were these?
I mean, it is really. I would also say that when you see, like, there's animals that are called notobiotic. It means they're raised in conditions where they don't have any bacteria. Those animals don't do well. They're susceptible to everything under the sun. Having normal bacteria present there is crucial for nutritional and immune function and a whole bunch of other metabolic things. Our gut flora have major influence on whether we get cancer. They have major influence on whether we get diabetes. They have major influence over whether we get obese. They have major influence over whether we get depressed. There was a study where they took dogs and they divided the dogs. They had a behaviorist go through, and this was from a confiscation from a dog fighting thing. They divided them into aggressive dogs and less aggressive dogs, and they looked at their gut flora, and they could pick out the aggressive and less aggressive dogs by their gut flora. So they're having huge, you know, they have huge influence over the way we behave.
Amazing.
I can't say that they may just be coming through, and they may not be harming the tortoise at all. They may be wiping out the important normal flora and causing this. But I'm suspicious that I'm suspicious that it plays a role, but I can't definitively prove that.
Okay, so I may have missed this part. What other animals or species has this particular bacteria been found in?
They're found in the diversity of, I mean, obviously humans and Helicobacter pylori, which is just one of the Helicobacters we get, but it's the one that's associated with stomach ulcers. I'll get it. But they're basically, if you investigate Helicobacters, they are commonly associated with GI tracts in vertebrates. Related to Campylobacters, which are some of the causes of diarrhea you run into in people, their niche seems to be enteric.
Is there any way then to determine how these individual gopher tortoises acquired this bacteria?
Not at this point. I am concerned that this may have come from invasive species. I should say, on a tangent. While we were working on this, some of the folks at the Wildlife Conservation Society approached us because they were working on endangered Cayman Island rock iguanas, which are, you know, a species that was down to under 100 animals not very long ago. And they were seeing these animals just come in, get really lethargic, and die. And they were looking at blood smears from them, and they saw there were spiral-shaped bacteria present in their blood. So that's when they contacted us and said, hey, can you work this up a little better? And so we did, and we found that this was not the same Helicobacter, but a very closely related Helicobacter in these rock iguanas. And even when they would treat the rock iguanas, they would no longer see the bacteria in the blood, but they would be dead within a week, whether they were treated or not. When we looked at those, we were like, that's a concern. And they had, on the Cayman Islands, they have invasive green iguanas as well. And we did find the same bacteria in invasive green iguanas, and the invasive green iguanas weren't getting sick. So that's certainly a suspicion as to, you know, what may be happening. We have a lot of, Florida is a place where invasive species come and thrive, and yeah. we have a lot of invasive species in Florida.
It's such an unfortunate thing that the invasive species seem invulnerable to anything, and our own native species seem to be adversely affected. Well, let me ask you this: I mean, with those iguanas in the Cayman Islands, where you know a kind of bacteria like this, a spiral-shaped bacteria, was kind of discovered. Were they able to determine whether that affected the other bacteria that should have been there?
We don't have that sort of data from that that set.
I only ask, and obviously I don't know the first thing about this sort of topic, but I find it really perplexing, and you must as well, that you can do some course of treatment, essentially eliminate this particular bacteria that you're talking about, and still the animal will succumb.
Well, it's a very short period of time where we're seeing, even with treatment, we just seem to be able to remove the detectable numbers of bacteria, but they may have already done their damage at that point. You know, there may be a toxin present. There are some toxins that have been shown to be present in other Helicobacter species, and if it's kind of come in and done its thing, we may not be able to. It may be too late.
Let me get you to discuss some of the things that harmful bacteria can do to the body of an animal.
Sure. Oh, you would like me to?
Yeah, please. Yeah, please.
There's a wide variety of. I mean, it's some of the most potent toxins known are bacteria. Actually, a different story relating to gopher tortoises in the paper that's coming out in Journal of Wildlife Diseases in the next couple of months is you probably heard of diphtheria in humans. It's a Carinibacterium diphtheriae, and it used to be a huge problem of kids until there was a vaccine around. It would infect their retropharynx, and there would cause so much necrosis and swelling and tissue damage that they literally wouldn't be able to breathe and swallow. So it's one of those things that vaccines have really improved our childhood, survival rates. The toxin produced is diphtheria toxin is a really, I mean, it takes like one molecule to kill a cell. It shuts down protein synthesis, shuts down the ribosome and the cell. And that is, a toxin that had been pretty localized to Carinibacterium diphtheriae. There's Carinibacterium ulcerans and Carinibacterium pseudotuberculosis, some really closely related organisms. But it had never been seen outside the genus Carinibacterium. And there's this other bacteria that we were working on in gopher tortoises. It's a very different presentation. It causes these big swollen, big granulomas, big lumps in the tissues. And, the immune system tries to respond and doesn't quite kill it off and keeps adding on more layers. It's what your lungs do with tuberculosis. So we had this tortoise come in, and this was something I first saw in a king cobra, actually. This animal would get these, granulomas all over the place, and we'd go in and surgically removed them. We identified the organism. It's now known as Ostwickia colonae. It's the same group that tuberculosis, the same phylum that tuberculosis belongs to, the actinobacteria. And they tend to be a pain in the butt that they're not easy to identify with our standard biochemical methods, and they're not easy to treat. If you get tuberculosis, you're on a combination of four drugs with just regular plain old stuff for months. Generally 6 months out, you reevaluate and see where they're at. So they're very challenging to treat. So we had this cobra, we would get it in, and we would surgically remove stuff and treat the cobra. And you treat a king cobra for a certain number of times, and then eventually it says, "No, I'm a king cobra. You're not sticking me with needles anymore."
I was going to say, it's very noble of you to even consent to treat a king cobra.
They're wonderful animals. They really are. They're dangerous, but they're wonderful. They're very intelligent. We would treat it for a certain period of time, and then it would become, "You can't do this anymore." And so we'd written the case report, and literally the day it came out in print 2 years later, as soon as it came out, the animal recrudesced. And we treated this animal every couple of years because, he would not let us treat him long term, and it would recrudesce. And we would go back in and surgically debride and start over and then get stuck behaviorally, this is something that had only been seen in captive animals until fairly recently. We saw it here. There was Chinese crocodile lizards are an endangered species over in China. And they had some problems where they were trying to do some captive breeding programs over there. And they got it in their population. There was a group up in Tennessee where they had some tortoises at a zoo that died. It was first seen in Australia, where they had some zoo tortoises that had died. We didn't know where it was in the wild. Well, about a year and a half ago, we had this gopher tortoise come in with big lumps all over it.
Let me stop you there. Let me ask you how you see that, because I think of a tortoise as being covered in a thick shell. How do you discover?
Well, often to see some of the other lumps on the inside, we have to resort to things like CT scans and things like that, because a tortoise is a, bone box that has everything's hidden in there. But this particular one had a big lump on the side of its neck that it could hardly get its head into.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Drawn back. And there was also a big lump on its thigh. So we went and surgically removed those, and they were all full of granulomas, and it had this bacteria, and that's the first time we've seen it in the wild. So it's now here in wild populations. And of interest, the genome of the organism reveals that it has a diphtheria-like toxin present. It's the first time that something this closely related to the diphtheria toxin has been seen in other species besides Carinobacterium.
So, you know, it's tragic to think of these diseases affecting animals, especially, you know, vulnerable animals to begin with, whether it be these iguanas in the Cayman Islands or whether it be gopher tortoises. It must be alarming to people like yourself who have a passion for conserving wildlife. Do you feel a good deal of urgency even when you only see a couple cases, when it seems that it can be as lethal as this?
Yeah, I mean, that's what keeps me going is trying to put out as many fires as I can and try and figure out what's going on. It is very concerning to see species that you know are not in an ecological position to adapt to, you know, additional negative pressures in their populations, and there they are.
Yeah, yeah, okay. This is, we're going to stop and take our last break of the program. I want to remind listeners that this is Animal Airwaves Live on WUFT-FM. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Jim Wellahan. We're talking about the implications of emerging diseases in gopher tortoises and other reptiles. Back right after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Jim Wellahan, and we're talking about the implications of emerging diseases in gopher tortoises and other reptiles. And let me ask you this, Dr. Wellahan, where do things stand now? You mentioned two gopher tortoises that were discovered with this particular bacteria, and you mentioned some of the work that that veterinary student had been doing. How much more have y'all learned, and have you seen a lot more cases?
Yeah, so the after, you know, those two index cases were kind of before Tasha had gotten involved with the whole survey project. We surveyed a fair number of tortoises, and that was where we got the statistical correlation between deaths and the bacterial load. Or specifically the Helicobacter load. It is definitely something we have enough animals from to say there is a strong correlation there.
Is there any way to prevent this? I mean, and if not right now, is there a way in the future to prevent this?
Well, I think one of the first things we need to figure out is how widespread is this. That'll be some of the upcoming studies, because we've primarily been looking at rehab populations, and it is a concern. I mean, if we're, you know, that is one of the challenges about rehabilitation, is you have animals coming in who are stressed and with the resultant immunosuppression coming away from that, and it's a great opportunity for it's a double-edged sword, because when you look at the animals who are sick and stressed out and all those other things, that's when all of these, you know, pathogens are going to flare up and you get an opportunity to identify them. But it's also an opportunity for them to be transmitted in captivity, you know, and so we try to be as stringent as we can about biosecurity and you know, wearing gloves and appropriate PPE around, you know, and it's gotten easier in the age of COVID because everyone wears a mask all the time anyway in the hospital, practicing good biosecurity, so we're not transmitting things in captivity. But it's a significant risk when you take a bunch of stressed animals and put them together in an area. And quite frankly, a lot of wildlife rehabilitation settings are stretched to the limits of their resources anyway. And so they're you know, understaffed and the caseload is higher than what they can often support. So it's a challenge for a rehabilitation setting not to have some of that transmission. But it's a wonderful place to go figure out what's out there.
And I assume that these individual animals are coming from a larger geographical area. They're not all coming from, like, one location, right?
Yeah, we tend to get in for the we have a the Bachelor Foundation has funded the University of Florida's wildlife rehabilitation program, so that pays for our medicines and things like that for us to take care of the native wildlife here at the University of Florida. And it's really, we don't go out and get things, but the public brings them to us, and so it's generally within driving range of Gainesville, you know.
I mean, these animals are getting this from somewhere and or something in the environment, right? Or
yeah,
you know, I mean, is its origin another animal, or is it like the environment itself?
I expect it's from another animal. The Helicobacter don't tend to be organisms that survive all that well in the environment, so they're probably getting it directly from another animal, but I don't know that for a fact. That's my best guess.
Let me ask you this: you know, there are other vulnerable turtle and tortoise species in Florida.
Yes.
What are the chances that this becomes something that other species will present with at some point?
I honestly don't know.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're somebody who spends a lot of time thinking about and studying kind of novel pathogens. Where does this rank on your kind of like order of things you're worried about?
It's significant. I guess I would say that it doesn't. It's somewhere in the middle, I guess. There are things that scare me, oh, this can come through and wipe out a species in a short period of time. And there are some things that are like, well, this just kind of seems to be out there. And if other things aren't coming together. But I think more what I worry about than any individual specific pathogen is the big picture and how are all these things interacting and what are we doing, you know.
Yeah.
It's the straw that breaks the camel's back is may not be that big a straw.
Yeah, right. And as you know, as we talked about before, there are so many different forces that seem unrelated to one another, but they all combine to make an environment in which vulnerable animals are that much more at risk. And you know, I think that, you know, if we're going to have a wonderful diversity of wildlife in the future, we all need to be maybe a little bit more conscientious of how these animals are experiencing these pressures, even if there are some components of that that we have little control over.
Yeah.
There are others that we do, although, you know, a variety of factors, many of them related to money, kind of will prevent action from being taken.
Yeah. And that's the big concern. I mean, it's, you know, when the climate changes, or as the climate changes, I guess I should say, there are going to be some species that are going to be able to move some. You know, if you look at where, you know, I mean, I think you've probably noticed that the cranes don't seem to migrate at the same times they used to, and all, and you see birds shifting around their migration patterns. Tortoises can't shift around their migration patterns.
Right.
They're kind of stuck here. And if, you know, Florida goes underwater, they're going to have a hard time getting out, you know. And so their ability to adapt in a geographic translocation sort of thing is definitely that. There's been a lot more thought and effort put into the desert tortoise out in California as far as, you know, they've been better at acknowledging climate change as a reality. Are they going to start translocating tortoises to, you know, as it becomes, you know, as the climate in San Francisco becomes more like San Diego, you know, are they going to start moving tortoises up, and how are those things going to go into place? There really hasn't been that much discussion of that here in the Southeast.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of the major things to consider here is that, you know, the pace of climate change right now is accelerating more quickly than evolution is accelerating, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if they were all kind of moving in sync, well, that'd be one thing. And it is easy to imagine that, you know, a fish that lives in the mid-Atlantic could just swim a little bit further in the North Atlantic,
yeah.
But you know, when you're talking about places that are otherwise geographically confined, like, I don't know, the state of Florida is just a big
polar bears don't have much further north to go.
Yeah, well, sure. Yeah. And there's just countless examples of that. And, you know, the gopher tortoise is probably just one of hundreds of species, you know, that are at risk in this way. You know, and you add to that a kind of a bacteria that it's not used to. Well, when you were treating these bacteria, I wonder, did you use antibiotics? Is that what was selected?
We did use antibiotics. We don't have any evidence that it really helped much.
Yeah.
We would treat these animals and they would seem to die anyway if they were seriously clinically ill.
Well, did the antibiotics that you gave them also affect the other bacteria that should have been there to begin with?
Absolutely, they would have. And part of it is too, generally when you're looking at what antibiotics are appropriate for something, the first step you're going to do is go culture it and then try and grow it in the presence of the different antibiotics. And that's how we get susceptibility profiles. We haven't successfully cultured this bacteria, so I can't even say for sure exactly what antibiotics this particular bacteria would be susceptible to.
Yeah, I mean, it all strikes me as very alarming. So, what are the next steps here?
Well, the next steps are to start looking at where is this bacteria now present in the wild, and you know, are other populations throughout the range of the gopher tortoise naive? And to start working out culture systems and to start looking at things like how, you know, what is the pathology of this? Is it, you know, is this thing producing some sort of toxin? Is this thing just wiping out the other bacteria and the tortoise is having other issues from that? Is it, you know, what is the mechanism of pathology we see here? And we don't have that yet either.
I can tell that this is frustrating. And yeah. I mean, you don't sound completely, you know, bitter about this, but I can see how it would be something that, you know, in addition to the other stuff that you think about, would just be another thing that makes you feel frustrated.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that are frustrating. I try to just, you know, get up and work on things as quickly as I can and try and get things out the door. And I'm very lucky to have some very dedicated people around me who are also kind of on the same plane. And I think it helps to have a group of people all trying to work together to make things better.
Yeah, well, and you know, to the extent that we as the public can do our part, at least the lowest effort thing that we could do is at least be informed.
Yeah.
Right. So, well, Jim Whalehan, it's always good to talk to you. I'm so grateful to you for coming back and joining me live this afternoon.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Jim Whalehan is a veterinarian at the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine. I also want to thank Sarah Carey over there for her help with the program. Thank you all for listening. I'm Dana Hill. This is Animal Airwaves Live. I hope you'll join me next week for another episode.